Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to speak now and welcome you here. Thank you for coming out on a night like tonight. This is probably the... I was going to say like the 10th or 11th job I've spent standing up and playing, but it's really been many more jobs than that. Actually, maybe I shouldn't call it a job. I shouldn't, but I can't think of anything else to call it on the spur of the moment. So I guess I'm trying to inform you that although I've been doing this for a while, playing vertically, I'm discovering night after night new things about it that aggravate me and that begin to sort of mitigate the gains I got when I the gains I got mitigate the gains. This isn't that much better than sitting down, is what I should say. Sitting down was a problem mainly with, as I discovered, stools. Stools are supposed to be convex, but concave. But as I've pointed out here, they are convex more frequently than not, and I am convex. So it was a clash, and I decided to give up. I was playing at a. I had a practical reason for it other than, you know, art for art's sake. I decided to give myself an extra edge at a nightclub that I played in St. Bart's called Autour du Rocher, which means around the rock, at least in my French it does. And it was called that because it's built around a huge rock. Actually, St. Bart's is a little more than a huge rock, but atop the rock of St. Bart's is another rock, and they built a club around this, which meant that the club... I have more to play tonight, by the way, but the nightclub extended out beyond the rock, so naturally there was nothing for the nightclub to sit on except four stilts about as big as my fingers, and I was at the far end of this nightclub where the stage was out above the very end of one of the stilts. There's a principle of resonance, I believe, in physics, or... In my physics, there's a principle of resonance. And I realized that if everybody started tapping their feet at the same time, and I was out on the end of the nightclub, I would soon merge with the rock 60 feet below and be the end of my career. So I stood up that night thinking it was a good excuse, thinking also that I could run out of the building if it started to give, which was folly, but it gave me, you know, a little courage to continue. So here I am, and tonight what I'm noticing is that your neck suffers this way, right here. But that's really a dialogue I should continue on my own time. This is a song called, another old piece. I have several new ones I want to play tonight, but this one I can't resist. It's called Ojo, and I wrote it after seeing a guy who was also vertical, but I don't know why, in a desert outside of Yuma. That's called I Yell at Traffic. There's a... I'm not sure what that represents, but I think you know what I mean. Thank you. I've also added guitar stands to my act. Once I stood up, I determined. Quite a while ago, I became a, it doesn't matter how long ago this was, I became a mechanic, or my version of a mechanic, you know, my version of French, my version of physics, and my version of a mechanic, which is who you see standing before you. And I've built, I reacted to the problems that I was having with my vehicle at the time by going to the Walker and ridding my mind of those sort of temporal concerns. And I walked into the Louise Nevelson exhibit there and realized that it looked an awful lot like the engine of the car I was trying to forget, and decided that I was possibly in love as much as I hated the engine of this thing. So I went home and I took it apart, and without much reason for doing it except to become involved on a sort of Louise Nevelson level with this vehicle, I did have an urge to sort of mimic what she had done, and I realized that that would be pure folly. And so I took this engine apart, which presented me with, I mean, I no longer had the problem that I'd had with it in the beginning, and I spent the next few years engrossed in this engine. And to say that I took it apart is an exaggeration, really. I did take the next one apart. I took it out of the car and took it completely apart, bored it out, had everything balanced, got new parts, anything that I could think of. And I made one of the fastest Fiestas that's ever existed in this state. It was a terrific, it really was a terrific car. The engine is the same thing they use in Formula Ford racing, and so there's 35 years of parts available for this thing, but not in Minnesota, I can tell you. And when I was done with it, which took me, I'm probably underestimating, but it took me at least a year to finish this job, which I think takes maybe a weekend for most mechanics, but not for me. When I was done, I started it. It worked beautifully as far as I could tell. And I called my family out to take a little spin in this triumph of mine, and discovered that I'd hooked up the transmission shift wrong. And so we drove around the backyard in reverse for a while. It didn't diminish the glow of my achievement one iota as far as I was concerned. But it, I don't, you know, it did something to my stature within my nuclear family. So I fixed it. Well, there, it went on and on and on. I mean, like it always does. And I got bored. Now, the third engine for that car is sitting on a stand in the garage, and the car sits beside it, and it has been there for quite a while. So I've returned now to other mechanics to get things done that I used to do myself. And I'm remembering why I tried to do it myself in the first place, beyond all those lies about Louise Nevelson. And naturally, I burst into song. Fix my car, what kind of fool you are? Why can't you fix my car? What kind of fool you are? It's just a Chevrolet. I drive it every day. I don't care what you say. Why can't you fix my car? Why can't you fix my car? Why can't you fix my car? What kind of fool you are? Why can't you fix my car? Why can't you fix it? Why can't you fix my car? What kind of fool you are? It's just a Chevrolet. I drive it every day. I don't care what you say. Why can't you fix my car? What kind of fool you are? Ring, ring, telephone ring. Somebody says, baby, what you doing? I've been wondering where you've been. Now and then I think about you and me. No use fighting about things we can't recall. 'Cause it don't matter now at all. Just come on in. Baby, we'll laugh and sing and we'll make love. Let the telephone ring. Ring, ring, doorbell ring. Come on in. I got Mel Blanc on the radio. I'm glad you came around. I've been feeling down talking to Tony and Mario. You know they make good conversation. Still it ain't no consolation. 'Cause I got love. Baby, I'll give you some. And if somebody comes, let the doorbell ring. Sun comes up across the city. I swear you never looked so young and pretty. Hand in hand, we'll stand upon the sand. Preacher band, let the wedding bells ring. Hand in hand, we'll stand upon the sand. Preacher band, let the wedding bells ring. This is a song I started to write after I first heard a tango player named Astor Piazzolla, who is a tremendous musician and really scary. It's disturbing music and utterly too beautiful, actually. Utterly too beautiful, actually. And it's there's a terrific album on Clave Records, which is the one that most recently got him in trouble. He's in his, I think, mid-60s now, and he's an accordion player, and he's at the peak of his career, and he's willing to take great risks. And he has a worldwide audience, but it's kind of secretive. Everybody keeps him to themselves. He came to New York a few years ago to perform, and he was... You know, he's not that, well, obviously, he's not that well known. His face isn't familiar to people in New York or anywhere else. And he was walking down the street, and a total stranger walked up to him and punched him in the nose and knocked him down and said, "That's for what you did to the tango," and probably a few other things as well. I don't care about the tango that much myself, but I've tried to write something sort of an Iowa, Minnesota sort of approach to the tango, and it's come off sounding, well, it doesn't sound like a tango. That's a tango, isn't it? Something like, no, it's not. No, right? Is it? Don't. It's a very seductive. My rhythm, though, is sort of. I cannot get away from that. It took me 20 years to learn it, and now I'm stuck with it. When I was living in Missouri, I heard about a guy. This doesn't have much to do with this song, but it's such a gruesome story that if I don't put it in here, I won't have an appropriate place to recover from it. When I was living in Missouri, I was functioning on one burner, maybe two, and I didn't know that at the time, of course. All I knew was that I was pretty miserable. I suspected quite nuts, and I came to this conclusion by judging my own behavior, which was extreme compared to those of my peers. And so the fact that I slept on a door that I'd stolen from the remodeling of a church next door to the building I was in, and that I was repairing the holes in my socks by writing on my ankle with a ballpoint pen told me that that I had the wrong idea, you know. But it wasn't hurting anyone, as far as I could tell. I left myself out of that equation, of course. So I chugged along on my one burner, thinking that eventually and hopefully it would all end and I'd be all right. Wait a minute, that was a part of a sentence that I didn't finish. That was a long clause ending with my ankle, and then I was supposed to get back to my subject, and I've forgotten what it was. So don't ever try that yourself, I guess, is what I was. Maybe it's a good example of it. But sometime during that stretch, I read about a guy named Charles Schmidt, who was a murderer. He'd been apprehended and sent off to prison, and he was insecure, which maybe is true of all murderers, but I don't presume to know. And he didn't like his height, so he crushed up beer cans and put them in the bottom of his boots to make them look taller. You'd think, I mean, there are things made for that purpose, but he was as enterprising as I was when I rebuilt my car engine, I think. I could have gone to a qualified professional to get my car revived, but I didn't. What I'm getting at is that there were more similarities between me and this guy than I was willing to admit. He not only boosted his height with beer cans in the bottom of his shoes, he wore a beauty mark made of motor oil on his right cheek and drove the main streets of Phoenix with his rearview mirror set up so that he could only see himself and keep an eye on this probably very mobile beauty mark that he had on his cheek. And while I read about this guy, I realized that there was, you know, that there was some connection between that beauty mark and the ballpoint pen on my ankle. I was learning more about myself than I ever wanted to know as I read about Charles Schmidt. It's sort of like when you're on a street corner and a guy rides by on a bicycle, and then a couple seconds later he's followed by his stink, and you're overwhelmed by this. That's pretty graphic. I'm trying to make the point here. But there's more to this, unfortunately. While he was in prison, he became a poet and started writing some poetry and was eventually, sometime after he began writing poetry, murdered by his fellow inmates, which is probably some form of criticism, but I judge it from the poems. And I know about the poetry. None of them have ever been published because I was playing in Phoenix and, you know, just in the spirit of good citizenship, I brought up one of their favorite sons, Charles Schmidt, and a huge groan emanated from the crowd, along with one sort of qualified yay. And it was, the yay came from a woman who taught in town and had some of this poetry and told me that she'd mail it to me. And when I got the letter, furthering my inclination that there was back then a link between me and Charles Schmidt, the note that she attached to these poems said, I hope these poems have as much of an effect on your life as your music has had on mine. So I didn't know how to take that, and I quit writing on my ankles. I sleep in a bed, and this is my version of a tango. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to take a short break. I'll be back in about 15 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was the guy going by on the bicycle. I had to. I can't get that out of my mind, actually. Try a different fret this time. Thank you. 8 miles high. And when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known. Signs in the street that say where you're going are somewhere just being their own. Nowhere is there warmth to be found among those afraid of losing their ground. Rain gray town, known for its sound, in places small faces unbound. In places small faces unbound. They are huddled in storms, some laughing, some shapeless forms. Sidewalk scene and black limousine, some living, some standing alone. Some living, some standing see, assuming this one's right. Hadn't been for Bach, I'd only have to play in two keys. I do that anyhow most of the time, so I shouldn't complain. This is a song that was indirectly inspired by meaning I wrote this song before I got the inspiration, but inspired by an experience a friend of mine had. I'll just call him Dave because he may not appreciate having this information spread around the way I've been spreading it around. But it's so germane to this tune that I feel compelled to slander his life and come out with this thing. It only adds to his already charming self. So, I mean, it's something only he would be discomfited by, not you or I. It's not nearly as discomforting as the guy on the bicycle metaphor, for example. That was just by way of explaining how sometimes you do get to know more about somebody than you ever wanted to. That's a compelling way to learn about someone. This guy Dave was a bass player. He is a bass player. He's one of the really great players on the planet. A lot of people, as many people know about him as know about Astor Piazzolla. But he's really extraordinary. I got to hear him play the Eccles Sonata, which was written by a guy in Handel's orchestra, a lute player, on the bass. While sitting on the floor just a few feet away. This was one of the six oldest basses in the world. And he's provided me with a lot of wonderful experiences like that. But he began as a cello player and debuted with the New York Philharmonic when he was 14 years old, playing the Dvorak Cello Concerto, and was a big hit, and which really... is mind-boggling, and it evidently was also mind-boggling for Dave. And because I just spit on my fretboard. Did you see that over there? The more than you wanted to know about. Anyhow, as I was saying, it was weird for him also because 2 weeks after this debut, he was sitting around his house with the cello over there somewhere, and the cello began to speak to him and tell him, you know, terrible things. And Buell was incensed and picked up his cello, which was on loan to him from some museum. I thought it was funny also, and destroyed it on the back of a chair to shut it up. Of course, it didn't work, so Dave was removed to an appropriate container for a couple of years, and it was during that time that he became a bass player. It was part of his cure to hang out with a piano player who was there permanently and taught him how to play the tonic on the one and the three, and he went on to become equally as much of a musician on the bass as on the cello. This is a tune I realized, wondering where it had come from all along anyhow, that could have been written by the cello that he destroyed. I don't remember what it was like to go back home. I only know it was cold and white, and I was alone. Won't you tell me how I could see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. Underneath the trees tonight, where little men sleep, all that snow will turn to ice while their lovers creep. Won't you tell me how I could see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. You should live in Dave's hands at Sunnybrook Park and count their little days there turning into dark. Won't you tell me how I could see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. Won't you tell me how I could see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. Everybody lies. Turned to rain, the weather turned to rain. Sunlight blinded passengers, washed them out to white. We said we love misery, maybe we were right, maybe we were. Way above Lake Erie, we got lost on wine. We said we know what we're doing, but we had lost our mind. We had lost our mind. Thank you. 10 years since St. Louis, it took that long to know. 2 years after we split up, we're back in Buffalo. Back in Buffalo. Back in Buffalo. I don't know if I mentioned this last year, but whether or not I did, I can't resist bringing it up again because I'm very fond of this discovery. A friend of mine who had some, you know, great credentials in the—he should know is what I'm saying. Told me that there's a theory around that creativity begins with lying. If you can't lie, you can't paint or write or there'd be no man-made beauty on the planet if it weren't for lying. If not for lying, and I know that Hemingway told us we all have a crap detector built in somewhere, and I think that works just as well when it's going off as it does, or when it's not going off as when it does. What I'm trying to say is that makes a lot of sense to me, that lying is the source of creativity, and nothing about it really sounds terribly wrong. And it explains why it gives me an out, I can put it that way. And I've had some... Well, I was sitting in the car one day when my kids were real small. And, you know what I mean. And... this wasn't too long since I'd been living in Missouri, so I was sitting at the wheel. The car engine was running. They were in the back seat, and I was trying to remember where it was we were going to go. It had really just escaped me, and it was my crap detector told me that I shouldn't ask them where we were going. So I gripped the wheel, trying to really bring it to mind. And excuse me. Excuse me again. So before I forget where I'm going, I'm going to stop playing. While I was trying to think, they began to amuse themselves, and which meant at that age just tormenting each other as much as they possibly could. It took some time before, you know, the screams really started to develop, because they'd evidently developed some tolerance for my forgetting wherever it was we were going to go from time to time. Anyhow, all of a sudden, a scream penetrated the car and my head. It issued from my daughter, and it was one of those sort of five-year-old or whatever screams that just, you know, they start here about this big and come out here this big on the other side of your head. It's not a wide scream. It's very narrow. And it's the kind of scream that always just made me forget the person who issued the scream and think about myself for a while. Tells you what kind of dad I was. Anyhow, I recovered because she said, in the middle of this scream, Joe stuck his finger in my eye. And I thought, oh, God. And I turned around to, you know, see what was left of her eye or where her eye was now. And as I was turning around, Joe, her brother, said, I didn't know that was your face. You know, so my heart swelled with pride because I knew I had an artist in the back seat. This is the same guy, by the way, who at that age got lost following an ant at a Dairy Queen. Isn't that wonderful, eh? What an ant. So I'd like to play this for them. They're here tonight, and I'd like to... And so is Sarah's eye. That's intact. I'd like to close with this. It's a medley of old stuff, old slide things that I don't seem to grow tired of. Thank you. Well, let me, I had, I've got a, that sounded sort of, see, I had something all planned and everything. I'm just staring over at where the... I can't do it on this. Larry, would you grab that 12-string? Let me get ready here. Oh, I should mention, since this reminded me of it, also it'd be commercially responsible of me to mention this, that we've made a show with production company called Perillo and Sanborn. It'll be on Channel 2 here and PBS nationally, and maybe in February. This tune is in it, and as I've discovered, a lot of my hits are in it because they wanted the stuff that was that they were the most familiar with. And I'll be back here next year at this. The same date. And I don't know what I've played. This is what my third time here at the Ordway, I think, and I haven't done anything for a long time other than just bring myself out. And next year, I remember one year when we had a guy who stood on one finger and somebody else who played three trumpets at the same time while he was on a pogo stick and a lot of stuff. So I'll try and do something like that. I think, or I don't know what I'll do. I'll be there. I'm the guy who didn't marry pretty Pamela Brown. Educated, well-intentioned, good girl in our town. I wonder where I'd be today if she had loved me too. Probably be driving kids to school. I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town. And I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Seen the lights of cities and I've been inside their doors. Sailed to foreign countries and walked upon their shores. I guess the guy she married was the best part of my life. She dug in cause he drove a pickup truck. I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town. I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Thank you. have to tell you just how beautiful she was. Everything it takes to get a guy like me in love. Lord, I hope she's happy, 'cause she sure deserves to be, especially for what she did for me. I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown, all of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town. I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown.